Hello and welcome to the Evergreen Way podcast, where we explore how to be a healthy leader for the long haul. My name is Andy Needham. I have the privilege of serving on the team with Converge Northeast. And today on the Evergreen Way podcast, we are talking to Justin Bluer, who is the teaching pastor at Berean Bible Church. They have multiple locations, but he lives and serves out of Green, New York. And if you are wondering where Green, New York is, you're not crazy. Many people have never heard of Green, New York. And what you're going to hear today, I love the fact that we have this podcast coming after last week's, or 2 weeks ago, where we had Derek Sanford on there. Derek talked a lot about how his church is reimagining leadership, volunteer staff positions. And Justin is actually implementing a lot of those things in a very different context than when Derek is. The town that Justin's church is in has gone from 6,000 people to just over 5,000 people. It actually has a declining population, and yet they have a growing church that is multiplying leaders and has actually found a way to do multi-site ministry in a rural context. And I think Justin is pioneering something. You will absolutely love his leadership, his humility, the way that he thinks about church and developing people and platforming people. Honestly, a rich and beautiful conversation. And I think that the church at large needs more Justins and needs to hear more of what this church is doing. If you've never heard of Berean Bible Church, again, just like Green, that's no surprise, but I believe that they are making an absolute impact for the kingdom of God in Central New York in a way that is really, truly special. So you are going to love this conversation. I cannot wait to share it with you. So let's jump in with Justin Bluer. It's my privilege today to welcome Justin Bluer from Berean Bible Church. If I have the name of the church right, Justin?
Yes, that's you
right.
Do.
That's right. And part of the reason that I am asking you that question is because we have been able to interact a few times. But honestly, you're someone that I've met since I started this job and just getting to know. So I'm looking forward to our conversation today because I feel like I'm going to get to know you better and get to share your story with our listeners here on the Evergreen Way podcast. So thanks for jumping on. And why don't you start by giving us a picture of where you are, what you're doing, what does life look like today for you and for your family?
Sure. Thank you for having me on, first of all, Andy. Just a ton of appreciation and respect for you and what you're doing. So I am a daddy to 5 kiddos. We got 3 girls and 2 boys between the ages of 6 and 14. And so life is fun. The home is loud. When the kids and Annie, my wife, are not home, I don't like going home because they're such a joy. We have a lot of game nights. My 2 older girls, Daisy and Lucy, absolutely love board games and card games. And I don't win as often as I used to, Andy. So I need help with my self-esteem. In fact, my 6-year-old son, Hudson, beats me at a lot of things now. And that's really a humility check. But we live in Green, New York, which is in central upstate New York. It's a rural area. We're surrounded by farms, and it's God's country up here. I guess it's the portion of New York that a lot of people don't know exists north of the city.
Yeah, it's a beautiful place to drive, rolling hills and cow fields and incredible people that you get to serve. And so we're going to talk obviously a lot about your church today and what God is doing, which I just love the story of what God's doing there, and he's doing a good thing. But let's zoom back a little bit. People here, you have 5 kids. They might think that's pretty impressive. But in your family heritage, you're underachieving. So give me a little bit of picture of growing up and what that looked like.
Yeah. So I grew up as one of 16 kids in the Buffalo area. So my parents definitely were rock stars, still are. Yeah. They've adopted 13 of my siblings from all around the world. And so have 3 siblings from West Africa, 4 siblings from Korea, brother from Vietnam, South America, just kind of all over the place. And our pastor used to call us the United Nations family. But my mom always desired to work at an orphanage, and she felt like God actually brought the orphanage to her. And so every time my dad saved up for a boat, which was always his dream, he would joke that they ended up buying another kid.
That's incredible. Where do you fall in that line of children?
I'm number six, which meant I was the oldest of the second batch. So I'm middle child with a bunch of older child tendencies.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, I think some of your like family birth order dynamics probably break or defy normative research just because of that beautiful upbringing that you have there. And as you have grown, you know, obviously there's a lot between that upbringing and pastoring today, but maybe is there a couple of people along your journey that have really helped form your faith, your worldview, your perspective on ministry?
Yes. My parents for sure are number one and number two. Both of them are teachers. Dad was a public school math teacher, mom, a special ed teacher, and mom chose to be stay at home. And I was K through 12, one of those homeschool kids. And I'm the unsocialized homeschooler who happens to love people and be an extrovert, but am pretty naive and was always pretty innocent when it comes to pop culture. So if we're playing a trivia game, you don't want me on your team. But I grew up with Andy Griffith, Little House on the Prairie, I Love Lucy, and The Cosby Show. And those are the four shows that we still watch with our kids and laugh our heads at today. But mom and dad were saved about when they had me. And so they were new believers and were growing quickly. And even though we were in legalism for a lot of my growing up years, it was with the right heart. So there were a lot of rules, but it was always fueled by this love and desire to please God. So they have poured their faith into me and really, really gave me a great foundation. A lot of people told my dad that he should be a pastor, and he responded that because of his past, he just felt like God didn't want him to do that. But he said, I believe that God's going to raise up one of my kids to be my Solomon and carry that torch.
Wow.
And so that never felt like a pressure thing. That was just always like, I was inspired by that because my dad has always fueled and believed in this ministry journey for me. They would have us read biographies growing up. And so a lot of my faith heroes are dead, but there are people like Billy Sunday and Charles Finney and Charles Spurgeon and Billy Graham and George Washington Carver and George Mueller. And those heroes of the faith absolutely spurred my faith and made me feel tiny. My faith is tiny compared to giants like that. And so even now we love having our kids read biographies and be inspired by people of faith from the past. So mentor-wise, once I finished high school, I did an apprenticeship with my senior pastor, Dan Harley, and he totally was my dream pastor. He was the kind of guy that loved people. His preaching was phenomenal, and he grew our little country church into a church that was reaching people for Jesus every Sunday. And people would come to Christ every week. And I always thought, man, someday I want to be in ministry doing what he's doing in a context like he's doing it. So he let me study under him and he mentored me. And then during Bible college and seminary for 6 years, I worked alongside another mentor. His name was Bill Burkheiser. And he was one of those guys that was very wise, very different personality-wise than me. He was very introverted, really didn't like people a whole lot. Never felt like he was cut out to be a pastor, but was a phenomenal preacher, mentor, and counselor. And I learned so much from Bill Burkheiser as well.
So how did God lead your journey to end up in Green? Did you know where Green, New York was growing up?
Not growing up. I knew where the Binghamton area was because my grandparents lived here. But Green is like 25 minutes north of Binghamton and is a totally different world. So no, even my parents who were raised in the Binghamton area, I don't think they had ever even gone to Green.
Yeah. And so how did you end up there?
I was finishing up seminary and they developed a list of upcoming graduates that churches looking for pastors could reach out to. And the interim pastor here at Berean saw my name on the list. Something kind of sparked in him to reach out to me. And I was 20, 6 years old at the time. And I got this email saying, hey, we're looking for a senior pastor. Would you consider applying? So I went down to my senior pastor in his office and I said, I just got this email. I didn't solicit this. I don't know where this is coming from. And he looked at it and he said, what are they looking for? I'm like a senior pastor. And again, I'm 26. I'm a pastor of evangelism and discipleship, wet behind the ears. And he says, well, go ahead and throw together a resume, but don't worry, you won't hear back. And I guess God had other plans.
Wow, that's amazing. You've spoken a little bit about Green in particular, but let's talk about the church itself. You were telling me earlier it's about 50 years-ish old. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you know, the context has informed the ministry there, but in the journey that you've been on, you know, one thing that I think it's in the DNA of your church is really to be a church that, you know, loves the word of God and is obviously making disciples, but also is caring for people who are far from God. Like that is definitely in the DNA of your church. And so how has God, maybe probably part of it is the story you already shared, the mentors you brought in, but how has God cultivated that heart within your church? And maybe how have you been able to lead the church towards that type of a vision alongside others?
I think the magic sauce at Berean and the thing I respect and admire the most about this church is what you just mentioned. They have a deep love for the word of God and they will not compromise. They also have a huge heart for people far from God and they will do pretty much anything short of sin to reach people far from God. So to have both is so rare in my experience. Typically, it's one or the other.
Yeah.
And I just was very excited to come and be part of this church because I'm like, man, if you have that desire to reach people far from God, but you're also going to stick to the book and be a truth with grace kind of church, there's a ton of potential. And so when this church began, it was a Bible study in the community that was formed by people from tons of denominations that hadn't been taught the true gospel. And so this Bible study was led by a Baptist pastor from the Binghamton area who was teaching them the true gospel. And one by one, all these Christian people were getting saved. These church people were getting truly saved.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the Bible study was big enough where he's like, you guys can form your own church. And they called it Berean because they said, we want to be like the early Bereans and never take a pastor's word for anything again. We want to always be those type of people that second guess, go home and study it against the scriptures. So to me, that gives me safety as a pastor, is I know our people are going to do that. They're going to go home, take the message, compare it with scripture, and make sure that what I teach or any of our preaching team teaches lines up with the word of God. And if it doesn't, we always say, we already know who's wrong. It's not the word of God.
I love that. I love that heart. I love the story. You know, there's a lot of ways that churches start, but one of the most beautiful is that kind of organic, almost accidental church plant, you know, like, oh, we have a church now, you know?
Yes.
Again, it puts people like me out of business, but I think it's one of the best ways that it happens. So, you know, Justin, I've gotten to sit under your teaching a couple of times now, and, you know, I know that you love to teach and you're very gifted. Obviously, you have that in your heritage, your parents being teachers, but as a steward of God's word, you know, and when you have that passion and that gifting, there is a temptation. There's a lot of temptations, but one of those is to build the ministry from the front and to hold the pulpit as your own and not to share it. And I just have a lot of respect because that's really something that you have fought and made intentional steps against that type of a ministry. So maybe you could describe, you know, your title is one of those things, the way that you lead, the way that the teaching happens at Berean. Can you speak to those things a little bit?
Sure. When the church hired me as senior pastor, I was immediately the youngest guy on the team. There were two other guys that joined the team about the same time I did, and both of them were older. But I noticed that people would skip those offices and come directly to mine when they had questions or when they needed decisions made. And I was confused by that. I'd say, well, why did you go to me? Why didn't you go to this pastor or this leader? And they'd say, well, because you're the boss. You're the senior pastor. And that got me very concerned because that wasn't the way that I think God designed his church. I think he designed it for Jesus to be the boss and all other shepherds are under shepherds. And we also had just shifted to an elder-led model. So there was a plurality of leaders, but my title didn't reflect that. So I just asked the elders, could we shift my title to be something that reflects a co-equal team So it's not a power title. It's just a responsibility title of teaching pastor. And they graciously said yes. And I've been teaching pastor ever since. That didn't change things overnight. It took years of teaching people that we truly were a co-equal team. And it took years of not making almost any decisions myself. I would always say, I'm going to take it to the team and I'll get back to you. So we moved really slow the first few years as we tried to reteach people how our team structure was going to work and that they weren't going to be able to pit any one of us against each other.
How long into your tenure was that you, at least in title, made that shift? I know you said it was a cultural shift that took time, but
it was pretty early. I think it was, I'd have to look. I think it was within the first year.
Wow. And then in terms of the pulpit, you know, one of the things that we are seeing as an increasing trend, and I think it's a great trend, is that pastors are, many pastors who are the primary teacher at their church are teaching less. And that's not because they're trying to take more vacation time or, you know, have an easier job, but actually they tend to want to do the hard work of, one, being involved in all the other elements of pastoring, and two, developing emerging leaders. And as someone who is really looking often at the future of the church and thinking about the fact that we are at such a deficit for developing the next generation of pastors and church planters, I think one of the barriers that we have created in the church, and you know, made by many well-meaning pastors who have very fruitful and faithful ministries, is not creating enough space for emerging leaders to develop the gifting of preaching in the church. Not just like you can go do that over here in the side little project, but actually develop them for Sunday morning. So, one, I commend you for that. I love that trend line. You're a leader in that. That doesn't mean that that's easy. It probably didn't happen overnight, and it does take some intentionality, or I should say a lot of intentionality. So maybe you could describe to us how you have cultivated that and how you develop emerging preachers within your congregation.
For sure. I had been trained by some godly people to not preach every week, that it's healthy to have multiple voices speaking to your people because you want to train them to listen to God's voice. And one of my biggest fears, I'm not a fear-based person. I don't have a lot of fears, but one of my legitimate fears is that I would lead a church that would follow me. And I never felt like that's a true church. Like a true church follows Jesus. And I've always wanted to be replaceable. So if I go down or God takes me somewhere else, the church doesn't rise and fall based on one person's gifting or voice. So I made it a goal to never speak more than 30 to 35 times a year from the beginning, which meant I instantly needed to start training guys to preach. So just started with three guys who I felt like were 2 Timothy 2:2 type of guys. They were reliable guys. They were respected in the community. And I felt like they were qualified to teach others. And just began doing how to study the Bible training with them. And then I'd have them prepare something to share with our little group. And then I'd let them know, okay, you're going to preach that on Sunday. And, you know, then the eyes would get big and I can't do that. And then they did. And it was cool. And one of those guys went on to be a pastor here. Another went on to be an outreach director. And another moved down to Georgia and is working with at-risk kids and doing an awesome job. But it was just so awesome getting to work with just lay guys, teaching them how to teach and preach. And that's where I just think that the Protestant Reformation, like it was meant to take the gospel and the scriptures and make it accessible to the common man, but we've professionalized the leadership of the church way too much again, especially lately in America. And so I want the power, the authority to go back to the people. And I think a lot of us do. And I think when lay guys are preaching, it goes a long way. And teaching people, they can read the Bible and understand it for themselves. They can be equipped and trained to teach and communicate the word of God for themselves. They don't need a professional to be the one in the pulpit. So now we have a team that's bigger. We have a team of 8 communicators, our teaching team, and some of them are pastors. Some of them are non-pastor staff members, and some of them are lay guys. And, you know, one guy is an entrepreneur. Another guy is a financial advisor. And any given Sunday at any given campus, people don't know who's going to be preaching at their campus. And we're intentional about that because we don't want people to select where they go based on who's speaking. Yep. We tell them, listen, you may not know who's speaking this Sunday at your campus, but you are going to get the Word of God, and it's going to be taught in a way that's clear and helpful. And so you can always invite friends, and you can always, as a believer, walk away with something from this. And so that's just created a healthy collaborative team now. We meet every week. We have an hour together to kind of brainstorm upcoming messages. We collaborate a year in advance on series, and then we're constantly refining that. And so by the time the final message is done, it's been collaborated on for a year by our team of eight and our elder team and the congregation giving us input. So our messages are getting stronger as there's more voices speaking into that. And just this year, our music director started sitting in on our preaching collaboration meetings, and she's now selecting songs that align better with the messages because she's sitting in and hearing the direction that the teaching's going. Wow. So I love being part of this team. This is the first year, Andy, I'm writing one message a month, and that's really weird and different, but it's such a joy because I'm taking what other guys are writing. All of us are personalizing that and getting to share that at different campuses each week. So it's a fun collaborative effort.
Yeah. Well, and you know, part of this is the fruitfulness of time and intent, like intentionality, but over time. I think that that's one of the things that often works against the local church. You know, we often want, you know, the classic, you know, this is a leadership line, but we, you know, overestimate what we can do in a year, underestimate what we can do in 10. In some ways, what you're describing is something that you cannot do this. Like if you're listening to this podcast today and you're preaching 42 times, like don't prepare one message a month, like next year, like that's not going to work for you.
Right. Like it took me 15 years to get.
Yeah. This is 15 years, synthesized down into a 5-minute, part of a podcast, but that is in some ways the beauty of what you have done is starting with that three, which is, you know, very Jesus-like, by the way, and then growing that over time, and then seeing where God will take that. You know, he honors that type of posture. And like you said, some of the fruit of it is people who've moved away, and not even all of them are necessarily teaching pastors somewhere else. But, you know, and there's such power for our congregations when they can hear from, you know, sometimes, you know, marketplace leaders stewarding over the Word of God. What they may lack in some of the sharpness of articulation and experience, they'll make up for because of the relatability factor, with who they're speaking to. And that's the diversity of voices. And
100%. Sunday down at our Hillcrest campus, Joe is preaching. He's a nice egg lineman. And we just had storms, so he's going to be up on poles all week. But man, the message he prepared, he sent it to me a few days ago, and it is phenomenal. And here, the message I'm delivering is on the same text, but I'm like, I want to ditch my message and go with his because this, he's so real. He's so authentic. And like you say, he connects with the people at a whole different level than I can. And his passion is just off the charts.
Yeah. You know, I tend to have a very generous perspective on different movements and models of church. And like, I want to maintain that. But I think that a shadow side of maybe the worst of the more attractional focused church has been the idea, like you said, the over-professionalization of the platform, and at its worst, also teaching biblical principles and maybe even sharing the truth of the gospel, but not unpacking and helping people understand how to approach the Bible for themselves. And so I do think like what you're representing, like we need to be, like we are products of the Reformation, but the church is always being reformed. It needs to be perpetually reformed. And I do think we're in an era, and we feel this a lot in the American church, of needing a reformation. And just like the reformers, really what they try to do is recapture the New Testament church. What we need is not some crazy new idea. It's just a new contextualization of old historic truths. And that's, you know, and the next generation will do the corrective to whatever we mess up.
Yes.
So, that's just a really important thing. You've kind of, you mentioned this in passing, but I want to unpack this a little bit because, when I think Green New York, first of all, I don't think a church of size, that in of itself is just unique. Obviously we've talked about the leadership dynamic, but you guys have chosen and calibrated to be a church that meets in multiple locations, and a multi-site church. And I think, again, people would have an instant inclination of what multi-site church would look like. They think Southern California, you know, fog machines and, you know, video preaching, which again, may be fine in the certain context, but that's not really what you're doing at all. So how did you come to multi-site and how do you do multi-site?
Yeah, great question. So a few years ago, I took a sabbatical when we were just at the beginning of this multi-site journey. And I'm like, I'm going to go visit the biggest multi-site churches in the country and just sit in on their staff meetings and talk to their team and find out how they do it. And so from New York to LA to Houston and Dallas, I just visited like the top however many churches in the country that I could get my foot in the door and talk to them. And I found that they had a lot of things in common. They were in thriving metropolitan areas where the population was surging. Yep. The main campus subsidized their other campuses by and large, and they didn't even have an expectation to sustainability for their other campuses. They viewed their other campuses like kids ministry. And they said, you would never expect your kids ministry to be self-sustaining. So our original campus is just going to be subsidizing these other campuses. So I came back home and I'm looking at our context and we're in one of the fastest shrinking small towns in New York. I think one year we were the fifth fastest shrinking. We went from 6,000 people in our village and town down to 5,200 the first 10 years I was here. And so we just were dropping off a cliff with population. And yet the church was growing, but you could see a sustainability factor. There's no way that this church could keep launching and subsidizing other campuses and other churches. So we said, okay, we've got to somehow scale this in a way that's sustainable, which means we've got to do a lot more with lay leadership. We got to do a lot smaller venue facility type situations. And we just need to be okay doing things differently because the model isn't going to work in our context. I personally was very much against multi-site. I did not like the concept. I thought it was unbiblical. And so if you and I were having this talk 12 years ago, I would have been pushing against it completely. There was a church nearby us that wanted to merge with us and become a campus. This was when we were a single site country church. And we just said, we don't know what that even looks like, but we're willing to have the discussion. And in that discussion, two older godly men push back on me about my disagreement with the multi-site model. And they exposed for me that my disagreement with it wasn't as much biblical as much as it was practical. I looked at the Mark Driscoll model of one celebrity guy and all of these campuses springing up and then failing if that one guy leaves. And I never wanted to be part of something like that. I always was more fully invested in the idea of just pure church planting. When we dove into the stats and found at the time that about 5 years after most churches were being planted that year, there was about an 80% death rate of church plants. And that year, there was about an 80% success rate for church campuses. Okay, so what, why, and I don't know that that's still the stat today. I don't think it is, but at that point it was, and I was very confused. Like, why is that the case? We had been talking to people in our church about launching a new campus about a half hour away from here. I'm sorry, not a new campus, a new church. And we had about 50 people coming from a distant, very small community of 1,000 people. But every time we talked about planting a church in their community, we got the deer in the headlights look. So I switched the conversation after we learned that multi-site wasn't unbiblical. And even the early church in Jerusalem had a lot of multi-site characteristics. When you actually look at the centralized leadership and the multiple locations they would meet in, temple, houses, that sort of thing. So when we switched the conversation and said to those folks, hey, if we started worship gatherings in your community, would you attend and give and invite your friends and be part of it? And instantly the deer in the headlight look went away and it was a, yes, we would love that. Mm-hmm. And so our first launch, that merger did not work out, mm-hmm. but very shortly after that, we launched worship gatherings in a new community, half hour away, this tiny 1,000 person community, about 800 now. And it worked. I mean, it wasn't easy, but people came, they invited their friends, they invested. We renovated a truck repair shop, a semi-truck repair shop, and turned it into a little worship center. And we used the apartments as the kids' wing. And when you're reaching 80 to 100 people in a community that's 800 to 1,000, that makes a huge impact on that little community. And that opened our eyes to the power of using multi-site as a multiplication tool, like a church planting tool. And it made us think differently about the mission. Mm-hmm. So one of the things, Andy, I've always wanted to help our people do, whatever church I was in, is to do the Ephesians 4 model and to equip people for the work of the ministry. So if our job is genuinely to equip people to do the ministry, then we need to expect them to be missionaries. And so rather than being okay with sending money to missionaries overseas, expecting our people to think like missionaries. And so our Green Campus now has sent people out three times, large groups of people three times, to go launch new communities of faith in places 20 to 30 minutes away. And it was every time painful for the Green Campus and painful for the people leaving, but it was this sense of joy and mission. Like, we get to go to this new community and we get to help people find Jesus. And every time we just couldn't be more excited to see the results of that. Not as much about the growth, but the growth in the hearts of people who are thinking and acting like missionaries in their own region. And that has been just one of the biggest joys of my life to see that happen.
Yeah, I mean, this is an outlier story. You know, again, you're in a town of 52. I grew up in a town of 9,000, and I consider that to be a small town. I always joke that I grew up in a New England town without a Dunkin' Donuts, and that usually gets a good laugh. But you're talking about a town that's half the size. That's your starting point. And then you're launching churches into communities of 800. And I mean, you're 100% right. Like, if you have a church of 80 to 100 people in a town of 800, like, that's changing the spiritual climate of that community, like, without question. And you know, it speaks to a lot of things, the DNA of discipleship, and like you said, equipping the saints for acts of service, Ephesians 4, that you've woven in. How does that express itself? You've said a little bit about, you know, you don't know who's going to be preaching. You've said a little bit about using lay leaders, but like, maybe if I were to go to your Binghamton location or another one of your sites right now, what's happening there? Who's leading? How is this happening?
Yeah. And that's where the complexity comes in. Whenever there's growth, it gets harder internally because you have to develop systems that can sustain. And I'm a systems person, so I enjoy that part. It's really fun. But it's not easy. It's not simple. So when you do add, whether it's launching a church or a campus, you're always going to replicate who you are. So it was important that we were really healthy before we did that, because we were going to multiply or replicate all of our issues. So trying to be healthy was part of being missional and thinking like missionaries. We need to be what we want to happen in these other communities. So there's a pretty strong team now. So we have multiple teams. We've got our elder team. Yep. We've got our preaching team. We've got campus teams. So each campus has a campus leader, either a pastor or director. Some of them are paid. Some of them are unpaid, but we still consider them staff. The book that's been formative for us on that is Untapped Church by Derek Sanford. Phenomenal book on rethinking paid staff. And that's just part of being sustainable. If you're going to be sustainable in small communities, you're probably going to need more staff that aren't paid. So we have campus teams, family ministry coordinator, and campus pastor or director at each campus. And then there's volunteer teams. And then to really make multi-site work effectively, we needed to build a central services team. And it doesn't need to happen when there's just two sites. But once you get to three or more, there needs to be an internal team that supports your campus teams. So now we have a music director that supports all of the music campus coordinators. We have a technology director that supports all of the tech volunteers at each campus. And just kind of in each area, having someone in a central role that supports the other campuses has been really, really helpful. It's taken a lot of work. We use Slack and databases and Google Sheets and internally we've learned from churches much further down the road from us, because it's all new to us. All of us on staff, I don't think any of us have been in a church this size before. And so it's outgrown us, and none of us want to be the lid, because sometimes people are like, well, I prefer a church that's a small church or a medium church or a large church. Who cares what we prefer? We want to see Jesus save every single person in this community. So I'm not going to hold on to what I prefer size-wise. I'm going to do everything in my power to not limit reaching every person in this region. And so I've had to throw my preferences out the window. I'm a small church guy. Like, I love being a Swiss Army knife, jack of all trades type pastor. And I've had to shift far away from that and kind of specialize. And in many ways, like, I've had to pull myself off the front lines, and I now get joy out of serving the people on the front lines and being more of an equipper of the leaders. And that's different for me, but I've found great joy in that. But I had to change, and there reached, this could be a whole nother podcast, but there reached a point where I had to either change, and so did one of our other pastors, because we're both small church guys. We said, either we change or we leave, because we're gonna hold this church back from what God's doing. And the growth was so far beyond us. We tried at one point when the church was growing fast to memorize 5 new people a week and learn their names, and we'd test each other. And then we realized, we don't need to know everyone, but everyone has to be known by someone.
Yes.
And so that was a shift in thinking. It allowed us to really develop healthy, small home groups. And the leaders of those groups now are lay ministers, and they are ministering, pastoring to those 12 or 15 people in the groups. Hmm.
So when I hear this, I mean, obviously I see the beauty of it, but I am also, as an organizational leader, thinking, like, it sounds a little chaotic, Justin. Like, there's going to be, and even just like, how do you make decisions on, for example, who is a volunteer versus who might be compensated? Is that driven by need? Is it driven by philosophy? Like, how do you make those kind of decisions as you guys are launching new campuses? Because I could feel on myself, like, there's the tyranny of the urgent, right? You feel like, oh, we don't have somebody to do X. And then there's the long term, which it seems like you're very good at seeing the process. So how do you kind of navigate those tensions?
I think those are tensions I think the key word you used was navigate rather than resolve. I don't think those are ever resolved. If there was a way to resolve them, write that book and it will sell. I think that's just the tension of ministry. And if God blesses it and it grows, that's something that every team, every pastor has to try to figure out. One of our pastors said it well in a staff training one day. He said, guys, we're growing, and it means there's a lot more there's a lot more challenges because there's a lot more people. And he said, he gave the analogy, I think it was of a horse farmer who was going from 1 horse to 5 horses. And he said, when he went to 5 horses, he had a lot more poop in the barn. He said, guys, we have a lot more poop in the barn. So we've just got to understand, like, that's the way it's going to be if we're going to reach more people for Jesus. And we have to be okay with that. Making that decision on who's paid or unpaid, those are conversations that we have constantly. Derek Sanford taught a breakout session with one guy we were about to hire, and he heard the Untapped Church model. And he came out of that session and went to the elders and say, hey, I still want to be hired and be on the team as a campus director, but I just don't want pay after hearing that session. So he like self-identified himself as a lay person that didn't want to be paid.
That's amazing. I love that. You know, if we strip it back even further, I mean, obviously there's a lot we could talk about with multi-site, but at the genesis of all this, and you said it yourself, like, you had to make a decision about, do we want to operate like a small church or not? And there are a lot of great small churches. That's not a judgment. But in terms of the idea of being a missional church, so let's not even focus on scale. Let's focus on you mentioned those two priorities. We're going to be biblical, and we're going to be all about people who are far from God encountering the beautiful gospel of Jesus. What do you think are the obstacles that in our more rural context in a 50-year-old church, you could use your own story, but you're, in many ways, your context is the most common in the Northeast, to be honest with you. There's thousands of small town churches. and beautifully faithful kingdom workers. But there are sometimes, some, you know, like any model of church, there's obstacles. So how do you, what do you think are some of the common obstacles or things that you've encountered? Mindsets, traditions, grief over loss, like you said, not knowing everybody. Like, what are some of those things that you would talk about?
In our area, there's two big factories. Right here in Green, there's the Raymond factory, and they build forklifts. Down in Kirkwood, not far from here, there's the Frito-Lay factory, and we all know the delicious chips that they make. But if you were to go to any of those employees at Frito-Lay or Raymond and say, how do you make forklifts? The Raymond employees would immediately tell you about the assembly line process. They know what that process looks like. And if you go to Frito-Lay and say, how do you make those chips? They would instantly tell you what that assembly line process looks like. But then you go into many of our churches and you say, hey, how do you make a disciple? And you ask 10 people and you'll probably get 10 different answers. And so we realized pretty quickly, like if we're gonna make disciples, that's the Great Commission, right? Teach people to obey, go and make disciples. That's the key command in that. So if we're gonna make disciples who are learning to obey, we've got to reverse engineer. So we got a team of people together and we just said, okay, what does it look like to be a follower of Jesus? And we painted a picture of what that looks like. And we say, okay, now how do we get there? And we just began developing a process. And so we don't call it an assembly line. We call it a growth process, but it's just three stages. We call it 101, 201, and 301. And 101 is just, how do you grow in your faith? What's the gospel? What's baptism? How do you study the Bible? How do you pray? Very, very basic. 201 is, how do you share your faith? And we want really quickly to teach new believers because they are the best soul winners. In fact, some of our best soul winners at Brian have been people who aren't even saved yet, but they're bringing their friends and family. And then 301 is, how do you identify and activate your spiritual gifts? Once you've done those three, 401, you never graduate from, and that's becoming a mentor. And that's that whole idea of, we're going to equip you to do the work of ministry, which includes making other disciples. So that's for sure, when you peel back the onion, that's the secret in the middle of the growth, has been people growing in their faith and then having a very simple way to turn around and help their friends grow in their faith. And then they're the ones baptizing them. And I'm telling you what, when someone brings a family member or friend to church, they get excited when they get saved. They then mentor them. They get in the tank with them and baptize them. That is absolutely addicting to followers of Jesus. And so we've seen over 500 people get baptized. And every time there's a baptism, I mean, that's like someone won the Super Bowl for us. That's a major. So we don't count conversions at all. We don't do the hand raise thing. We only count baptisms.
Okay.
Because that's when someone's going truly public with their faith. So I think that changed mindsets, because no longer was it, hey, I'm going to bring them to the pastors, I'm going to bring them to church. It's, I know how to share Jesus with my friends in a really simple way. We train people to write the gospel, the bridge illustration, out on a napkin in a restaurant. And people are just sharing Jesus with other people, with friends and family. And then they're mentoring them. And we all know the stats that when someone comes to church invited by someone, they're much more likely to stick. But then you add to that, they're mentored now by the person who invited them. They're much more likely to receive that from someone they respect and trust. And it just creates, you know, easily second, third, fourth generation of Christians, where they look around this church and they see people that came to Christ because they brought a family member, a friend to Christ, and they then invited that person who invited that person. And that's, I think, how multiplication happens. Mm-hmm. It's not about a show. It's not about a program. It's just, you should be able to go into church and say, how do you make disciples? And every person should know what that is. It should be really simple and clear.
Yeah, well said. And honestly, that shows, you know, it's easy to get caught up in the structures, the systems, the multi-site, and those are beautiful and good things. But at the end of the day, it comes back to the Great Commission. And that's where, you know, it's really, how do we live this out? How do we actually see this happening in our context with our people, that they're growing in the likeness of Jesus and helping other people do the same thing. So love that. Justin, you know, one of the things that I have loved so much about getting to know you and some of your incredible friends in Central New York, which has been a new area for me. I was a New England boy, so I had to learn New York. That was where the Yankees played. There are Christians there. There are many amazing Jesus followers, and we will root against each other on the football field. But I am so much rooting for you when it comes to the kingdom work. And I just love the thing that I love about you is you have a holy imagination, which I think the church needs more of. What could God do? Let's not just be copycats. Let's not just go to import, go to California, learn from them, but then have a holy imagination for what it looks like here. And then secondarily, you're a kingdom collaborator. And I'm sure you have had your critics in the day. Everybody who does something hard for God will have that, but you have fostered relationship. So talk to me about real quickly, as we kind of wrap up our time here today, how you have helped your people and you yourself have modeled collaboration. It's not really about logos and egos. It's not about Converge. It's not about NEC. But maybe speak about what the Northeast Collaborative is and that expression of relationship that God has given you.
Yeah, when I was new here, there was just this mindset among our people that we were competing with the church that had kind of launched us down in the Binghamton area. I'm like, where did that come from? I knew that pastor. We were friends, and both of us hated that mentality that somehow we're competing because we're on the same road 20 minutes away from each other. And so we just brainstormed, how can we break this? And we thought, well, we always say we're on the same team, but if we act like it, maybe that'll help. And so we're like, let's just do a series together and swap pulpits. So we asked a third church nearby to join us. And for a Christmas series that year, we just did, each of us prepared one message. We just rotated among the three churches and each of us preached it once at three different churches. And I'll tell you, that broke things open with our people. They realized, oh, these guys really do know each other, like each other, and we really are on the same team. And it was fun. That went from three churches to nine churches to 12 churches to 18 churches to 20. I mean, it just kept spreading because people are like, wow, we like this idea. Christmas is a busy season. It'd be nice to only prepare one message, and it'd be cool to preach in some different churches. And even to have different voices when you're in a smaller church, bringing in different voices for an intentional series and letting a friend who's a pastor, a couple of them, preach in your church is awesome. And we found that there were people that got saved under that other pastor's ministry because our voice maybe had gotten old or people knew how to ignore us, but they listened to that other guy. And we're like, that didn't make us jealous or insecure. That made us excited that they led someone to Christ that we had been praying for and preaching to for years. So that kind of heart of just collaborating and acting like teammates, Dan Nichols has that same heart. And we're like, yeah, we'd love to help form this new thing that he was doing called Northeast Collaborative. And it is a relational resourcing network. So it's doing those kind of resourcing partnerships in a way that's just a little bit broader across the Northeast, New England, New York, and PA. And it's doing it though through relationships. So one of the things even this year is Berean released me one day a week on Mondays to go work at Dan's church up in Cortland. And so we're like, I kind of joined their team as a pastoral coach and we're working together and kind of pushing the boundaries of what does this even look like to share staff? Like, is this, can we do this? Are we allowed to do this? Why can't we do this? And if some people have certain gifts and have the bandwidth to go serve in other churches in a part-time way, what could this look like to make this more of a normative, at least conversation? And I think God gets really happy when his kids act like they are on the same team. And when you look at Jesus' prayer for his disciples, like, I pray that they may be one as we are one. I don't think that means the ecumenical idea. I mean, it means being unified around the mission and acting together on that mission. And so the more churches in the area and in upstate New York, there's just a ton of those types of churches now. I think our Father's really pleased by his kids working together.
Yeah. I just love that closing with thinking about, you know, think about the things that Jesus asked us to pray for or did pray. He said, you know, pray that the Lord would send workers into the harvest because they are, they are like sheep without a shepherd. And he prayed that his kids would be one. And so when that can happen. And again, like you said today, you know, there's tensions, there's things that are hard about this, the messiness of humanity. There's poop in the barn. I guess I don't know if that, I won't use that as the title of this podcast, but that was a good quote and very contextual to where you are. So, Justin, thank you so much. How can people connect with Berean and maybe NEC? You could just mention kind of the web spaces that people could find those things.
Yeah. If people want to go on our church website, it's bbctransform.org. And if they want to reach out to me or the office, if they'd like any resources or just want to chat, I would love that. Our church specifically lets our team take a part of their week to serve other churches. So if I can help or answer questions, I would love to. And I know that's what a lot of pastors have done for us, is they've let us bend their ear and learn from them. Northeast Collaborative is anycollaborative.com. And you can get info on the team and the just the collaborative resourcing network that that is. And if we can help you in any way there, we would love to do that too. Dan is an awesome leader. Mike is a new church strategist on our team who's knocking it out of the park. So there's a really cool team of guys that are just fully sold out to resource and help, especially pastors. And our goal at Northeast Collaborative is to help pastors lead and launch well. And we want to bust the isolation that is all too common in the Northeast. There is no reason that even if it's a small church and the pastor's serving alone, they should not be isolated. And we'd love to help relationally connect them and resource them.
Well, thanks for your time. I love that as Converge and NEC, we get to model what you're doing at the church level as networks as well. Mm-hmm. And that the more kingdom collaboration we can see, the better in my mind. So thanks so much for being a part of that. Thanks for taking your time today. And I look forward to getting to continue to follow the journey that God has you and Berean on into the future. Thanks, Justin.
Thank you, Andy. It's my privilege.
Thank you for tuning into this episode of the Evergreen Way podcast. On behalf of our entire team at Converge Northeast, it is a privilege to bring you these conversations to help you to be a healthy leader for the long haul. We would love to connect with you. Find us on Instagram at Converge Northeast and feel free to send us a message. It's an easy way to connect. You can also send me an email directly at andy@convergenortheast.org. That's andy@convergenortheast.org. Let us know what resonates with you, as well as any ideas or suggestions for topics or interviews for future episodes. We appreciate it when you follow or subscribe on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and know that a positive review is a simple way that you can help more people discover the Evergreen Way. Until next time, this is Andy Needham with Converge Northeast. Thanks so much for tuning in.